If we could create a business that rewarded product development and technology and infrastructure and that can-do attitude, as well as the investment management skill set and the distribution skill set, you could marriage that great fiduciary culture with that great innovation that you get from banks, and you could deliver something interesting. And it doesn't matter whether that's craft beer or craft food, championing differentiation in a world of industrialization, I think is what we were all about. You know, that was the culture that we all joined and we still believe in very strongly today. 50% of our business by assets is focused on delivering solutions for retail investors. And then the other half of our business was being a fantastic home for hard to industrialize craft businesses. In a world where fees are continuing to be reduced, we need to make sure that we can maximize our margins. And the way that you maximize your margins is having the most scalable technology infrastructures.
Pacific Asset Management is an intriguing study in developing an investment manager in today's world and building it to last for tomorrow's. It was a business born from the Beckwiths family's long tradition of creating successful investment management firms, and is run by a man whose energy and clarity of vision is impressive. 10 years from inception and with $20 billion under management, it merits examination, especially given the immense changes taking place within the investment management industry. Matt Lamb, CEO of Pacific Asset Management, welcome to this Money Maze curated edition.
Thank you very much. That's the most impressive intro I've ever had.
Let's hope it doesn't all go downhill from here. So Matt, you and your colleagues and your backers started with a clean sheet of paper, as I said, 10 years ago. You built this very large business. You are, as you write in your materials, unconstrained by legacy systems or thinking, and you positioned Pacific Asset Management as a challenger with significant technology behind it. We're going to talk about a number of those. But at the very simple level, because you've been in this business for quite a while, what was the problem when you started out that you thought the industry wasn't solving?
Yes, that's an excellent question. I think when we looked at, maybe I'll go back one step. So I started life at a business called Global Asset Management, it then became GAM. It was owned by UBS and then Julius Baer, and then ultimately listed and ended up with how it ended up. But I guess that the first thing I did was I worked for an accountant who was an incredibly decent human being, and we worked incredibly hard, and no one worried about what they got paid or how they were remunerated. It was just real sense of fiduciary and solutions orientated approach, which I absolutely loved. And I think that the asset management industry is still very good at that. The problem was that sort of two people got paid. It was the guy that ran the money and the guy or girl that raised the money. That was the operating model, and I think still is the operating model of many asset management businesses. And I had done maths and computer science and studied that at school and at university. And I went to run alternatives at Deutsche Bank, and culturally it was a very different place. And banks are culturally a different place. Maybe we'll stop there, but I think that they tend to be a little bit more fragmented and a little bit more transactional. But within the banks, I met some of the most intelligent and bright people I'd ever met. And I kind of felt that if we could create a business that rewarded product development and technology and infrastructure and that can-do attitude, as well as the investment management skill set and the distribution skill set, you could marriage that great fiduciary culture with that great innovation that you get from banks, and you could deliver something interesting. And that was really how it all started. It was trying to take the best of both worlds, that sort of investment banking culture of getting things done with this sort of fiduciary long-term mindset that asset managers have done so well for many years.
I mean, we're going to examine a number of those as we go along, but there is a certain irony in that as you have grown very quickly, we see last week that Schroders has gone into the arms of a much bigger US institution. So at the high level of our industry, how do you think about that size legacy trade-off?
Yeah, I think it's something that lots of people talk about, is the sort of bifurcation of the industry. We talk about asset management. Or if we go back a step, when you said Sir John Beckwith approached me and Pacific Investments, which was their family office, and said, would I be interested in building an asset management business? The first answer was no. It's way, way too difficult. It's a massively industrialized you know, business. And he sort of said, humor me, you know, what would you have to do to build that? And I said, well, we would need to control the culture. So I was less worried about how much I owned of the business, but more how much I controlled of the business. In hindsight, that may have been a bad move. Technology was massively important. If we were unencumbered by legacy, if you were starting a new business, you know, why wouldn't you think about technology? And we needed to think about hard to industrialize strategies. In a world of industrialization, you wanted craft-based investment strategies, and you wanted to be a home that would attract the best craft investment talent. And that was the sort of genesis, you know, of everything. And I think we've seen this across every industry. You know, craft-based approach to things is something that people like. You can get close to it, you can touch it, it feels more tangible, you're more involved with it, it's more of a solution. And it doesn't matter whether that's craft beer or craft food, championing differentiation in a world of industrialization, I think is what we were all about. You know, that was the culture that we all joined and we still believe in very strongly today.
So let's march to today. Just give us the very quick summary of who you are.
There are two main things that we do. You know, 50% of our business by assets is focused on delivering solutions for retail investors, you know, intermediated retail investors. So through financial advisors, platforms, insurance companies, et cetera. And that's where we built a very tech-enabled solution that was slightly more on the industrialized end, but the differentiation was around engagement and tech and storytelling and empowering other people's brands. And then the other half of our business was being a fantastic home for hard to industrialize craft businesses. It's still a bit of the old, my fund is better than your fund, so please buy it. Well, that sort of is more of a product-led part of the business, although even that's evolved to delivering quite interesting solutions. And so we're 21.3 billion at the end of January. We're actually 9 years old. We're 10 at the end of this year. And it's almost exactly 50-50. I think it's 11 billion and 10.3 billion, 11 billion on the single manager craft businesses and 10 billion on the industrialized businesses.
So as I was looking at your business and thinking about it, I was wondering, what are the echoes of the airline industry, which of course got disintermediated by the low-cost carriers who brought with it an absence of legacy pension systems and ways of doing things and cost bases. And they brought, they brought technology, but maybe not, as we're going to talk about in a minute, not in the rapid evolution of technology that we've seen and that you're applying. You say in the materials that we aim to pioneer a more progressive and innovative model, and you list four things I'd like you to just reflect on, which is faster product development, lower operational overhead, more flexible fee structures, and advisor-friendly technology integrations. And just give me a sense of, you know, how, what they really mean.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is, in a world where the world is much more cost conscious, which is understandable because there's industrialized solutions you can buy incredibly cheaply, that one thing that no one has ever asked me is what my margins are. So what's very clear is no one really cares what your margins are. What they care is what they pay. And therefore, in a world where fees are continuing to be reduced, we need to make sure that we can maximize our margins. And the way that you maximize your margins is having the most scalable technology infrastructure. So we have 26 UCITS, two LLCs, a Cayman, and an active ETF listed on the NASDAQ. And we do that with, I would say, less than 50% of the operational support staff that a traditional asset management firm would have. And so that was the first goal. The second sort of benefits of that ended up being, well, the secondary effect of that was that actually we could hire great talent, because talent doesn't want to be rudely interrupted in their, you know, deep levels of thinking around what they should be buying or what they should be selling, with, you know, increased committee meetings, trying to understand how the tech works, you know, trying to execute, you know, working out which structures, multiple managed accounts, you know, that all the complexity that, you know, the legacy systems that incumbent asset managers have actually is a pain in the backside for the fund management talent as well. So we ended up with this thing where we're maximizing margins, but we're also creating a great home for talent where they can be, where they can sort of focus on what they want to do, which is run money.
So that actually brings me to something you said a little while ago, which is you describe your business as a home, not a platform. And I thought about that and I thought, well, actually, is that right? Because you are a home, but you're built on and you've built out this platform. So tell me how you decompose that.
Yes. So we think about the technology as an internal brand. We call it IPX. It's the execution of other people's IP. And so those other people, when we first started, all worked for PAM. And what's happened now is that actually some people are using that platform as a service. And we've written our first software as a service contracts where people can start to use the infrastructure. We do 25,000 fact sheets a year for people now. And I remember one of my old CEOs coming to meet me, and I was so proud to tell him how much money I'd raised. And the only question he asked me was, how the hell have you done 25,000 fact sheets? You know, tell us that secret. And that's all about, positive data. But what we mean by a home, so absolutely the technology is a platform. It's a platform that supports all of us. But what we mean by us being a home, not a platform for the talent, is that, you know, when I worked at Deutsche Bank, we ran a lot of platforms. And you end up with, when you feel it's a service and things aren't working on either side, that creates friction. You know, everyone's got a view on how that service should be performing. And so if fund managers don't perform well, the sales guys say, well, why haven't they performed well? You know, if fund managers perform brilliantly, they ask why distribution hasn't raised them the money that they expected to raise. So you end up with this slight barrier between you and, you know, the talent on either sides, whether that's infrastructure talent, distribution talent, investment management talent. And a home is very different. You know, a home is where we're sort of family members, yeah? And therefore, when things aren't working well, you want to, you know, we have an emerging market strategy that's been hugely successful, but there are times we didn't own Alibaba and everyone thought we might've been lunatics. And our fund managers explained very eloquently why we didn't do that. And we would, even if they were underperforming, I could cut one of my sales guys in half and they would tell you exactly the reason why we weren't in Alibaba. There was this great camaraderie between distribution and fund management. And investors want to be part of that. They can see that in the room. There's nothing worse than an asset raising meeting where you can tell the fund manager and the distribution individual hate each other, you know? And so being at home, we wanted to create a support network and an infrastructure that people felt part of this collaborative approach. And I think collaboration happens amongst families, regardless of the tensions that people have within families. There is underlying sort of, it sounds cheesy, but love for each other. And I think that's what, from a culture, we wanted to create. So, you know, to finish on that, I think, you know, sometimes it's a bit like other people's children. You know, when they're in your house and they're really well behaved, you wish your children were really well behaved. You know, if they're really badly behaved, you get to throw them out of your house, but you can't do that with your own children. And so if we're a family, we recognize we can't throw each other out, and therefore we're going to work collaboratively to make sure that it works for all of us. And that is the culture of a home versus the service of a platform.
We're going to come back to that cultural piece a little later on, but let's just talk about the investment solutions or the investment offering. You know, you have been a home to a lot of managers and a lot of different styles. And you said that in identifying a manager that you want to develop or a style you want to develop, you want to see four things: provenance, less love strategies, scalability. Those are three. I can't remember the fourth.
It was the three.
Okay. And talk me through your strategic thinking. It might be tactical from time to time, about where you want to have managers with you.
Yeah, so I don't think people come to a firm like ours for, you know, mass market industrialized products. And so us claiming that we have an edge in strategies that are sort of very much in the mainstream, which are perceived to be efficient, I think is difficult. And so when you look at those points, you know, how do we determine provenance? Okay, there's lots of ways you can do that. Track record, how long they've been in the industry, those sort of things. But actually another way that we look at is whether previous investors that have invested them with them. And often that's not necessarily clients. It might be even people they've worked with. So a number of our managers, when they launched, you know, were launched with investments from their previous bosses, their previous employers, and those sort of things. That is the ultimate, you know, compliment and validation, I think. Then the sort of strategies that are unloved. What do we mean by that? We're pragmatic. We're not you know, contrarians and just saying everything that's worked is wrong. But we are trying to think about, you know, what the winners are of the next decade. And if you can buy stuff and invest in stuff and think about strategies that are unloved, they're usually the things that haven't gone up a lot, and therefore you get this all sort of embedded downside protection. So, you know, when we launched emerging markets value, those were the two of the most hated things back in 2017. You know, 10 years on, nine years out of nine outperformance, and suddenly emerging markets is flavor of the month, and we ended up with a cheap asset class run well. We've done interest rates. We had perpetually low interest rates, and we started trading relative value interest rates. And that was a thing that really played into the technology, because trading RV rates in UCITS, there's about three people that do that in the entire UCITS umbrella. So getting it in UCITS, trading, you know, derivatives, you know, understanding the risks associated with that require big technology infrastructure. And that is something that we've done. So we've, you know, more recently, we've looked at credit. Everybody's got excited about, you know, moving down the capital stack, you know, thinking about private credit and subordinated bank debt and all those sort of things. And we launched investment grade credit strategies that were actively traded, synthetically unitizing a prop desk with a joint venture partnership with a business in Australia that ran $11 or $12 billion called Coolabah Capital. So we're kind of thinking the latest thing that we've done is another joint venture with a business called Maple Brown Abbott, which trade listed infrastructure. The listed infrastructure trades at a significant discount to the private space. You know, there's an element of super low vol cash flows, and there's really interesting inflation protection in that. And so strategies like that that have seen out of favor are starting to do really quite well. And so we spend a lot of time trying to think about the winners of the next decade, run by phenomenal people. And then the last thing we talk about, scalability. You know, by definition, a craft business can only be certain, you know, there's only a certain amount of scale that you can get out of that. And I would say when we think about you know, limited capacity, we don't mean in the hundreds of millions, we means in the 5 to 10 billion, but we don't mean in the 10 to 100 billion. So we're typically building strategies where we see there is enough applicability that you can raise, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5 billion, but it's, we're not trying to create something where we're running $100 billion in emerging markets, you know, which we've seen some of our competitors do. So it's scalable enough to be relevant to our clients. It's scalable enough to be relevant for distribution and to be economically viable. There's enough scale there. There are strategies that are unloved. So people always want to see us. Doesn't mean they want to buy it, but they're interested about what we're selling. You know, and they're with people that typically have great provenance that only want to run money. And that we often, you know, when meeting people, we often sort of test that case. Because often people will say, oh yes, I just want to run one fund. And I'll say, is it applicable? Could you do that, you know, US strategy in Europe? And they'll say, oh yes, of course we can. Could you do it in UK? Oh yes. Could you do it in small caps? Yes. Could I do it in large? Oh, it's repeatable everywhere. And suddenly that's somebody who wants to run a business. That's not somebody who wants to run money. And so we're very focused on people that want to run one strategy, one process. We might productionize it in slightly different ways, but they're focusing on doing one thing really well. And that's the sort of, that's the goal.
Well, when we listened to your colleague from Coolabah Capital at the Money Maze Allocator Summit, he had a lot of people going, wow, I need to know more about this.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the other half of your business is, which you referred to, is, I would describe it as the multi-assets, you know, space, which is a crowded and a highly competitive space. I used to run multi-asset money a long, long time ago. How have you approached something that is as, if not commoditized, but as competitive as it is?
So, well, you sort of said the word there yourself. I'm sad, glad you said it, because I sometimes get told off by my CIO. commoditized, I think, is exactly the right thing. Ironically, we want to be a bit business of craft-based fund managers. But what we worked out very quickly was that single strategies and craft-based fund management is still a question of my product is better than yours, please buy it. And that meant that it didn't matter how much infrastructure we built, if we didn't deliver on our returns, we were never going to be, it was never going to be a viable business. And so perversely, we started to look at the slightly more commoditized or industrialized sector. And multi-asset investing, particularly within retail, where there's a limited amount of building blocks, where they can't do private markets, where they might be constrained by risk profiling, you create an element of homogeneity. You create an element of industrialization. And now, what's interesting about that is that we were a business that had no assets. So we started to think about ourselves not like a fund manager, but as a financial planner. And we started to think about, you know, where is the alpha? And empirically, it became very clear that the vast majority of the alpha is determined by the level of risk you're taking, not by whether you use me or any of the other multi-asset providers or model portfolio providers out there. And the level of risk you're taking, effectively your risk profile, is determined by the financial advisor. There's the single biggest part, the single biggest driver, or one of the biggest drivers of alpha, is driven by the advice. It's where are you in your life cycle? Where are you in your journey? What risks should you be taking? What inheritance tax planning you should be doing? What general tax planning you should be doing? This is tangible stuff. You know, my father sadly passed away and we knew he was terminally ill. And he had bought a flat in London with my mother in the 60s that was now worth £400,000 or something. And they'd rented it out and they were sharing the income. And of course, this flat was going to go to my mother and she would have ended up having to pay inheritance tax or capital gains tax if it was ever sold for her to live, because she would no longer have a pension because my father was no longer around. And a financial advisor said, well, look, why don't you put it 100% in your dad's name? So we put it 100% in my father's name. And then when he passed away, it transferred it to my mom, and then she could sell it and avoid paying capital gains tax. So they saved about £85,000 of capital gains tax in about a 4.5 minute conversation. And there's me trying to make, you know, 5 to 10% a year, you know. And so it became very clear to me that a significant part of the outcome for a client is derived by the financial advice. So what we needed to do as fund managers was to deliver a solution where you can control risk, you know, controlling volatility, which is as much about risk management and maths as it is about, you know, investment management skills. And it's certainly not easy. Increases predictability. Volatility is a measure of predictability. You know, if you reduce volatility, you increase predictability. If you increase predictability, financial planning becomes easier. And so we started to think about how do we blend risk management, maths, deep investment expertise, which is a much more institutional mindset to retail, the retail management of money. And then we start to think, well, if it is homogenous or there's an element of homogeneity in this, you know, why are we championing our brand? Why shouldn't we be championing the financial advice? Because they're certainly delivering a big chunk of that alpha. It's not just us. And so we start to say financial advisors that if everything in the box is fairly similar, then the thing that differentiates you is the packaging in itself. You know, you throw your Apple iPhone box away, but it's the sexiest thing about the iPhone. And what we knew is if everything in the box at a private bank was similar, but you know, but guess what? They present it a lot better than the guy who runs a financial advisory business, you know, in you know, somewhere in the UK. And so we were saying, well, actually, why don't we elevate your storytelling and your messaging, and we'll use technology to do that. And that is why we've now white labeled, you know, solutions. We now run people's passive mandates, their active passive mandates, their income mandates, their sustainability mandates. And that business now raises £100 million a month of net flow. And so it's an amazing sort of technology enabled system. It's the marriage between deep investment expertise, technology, and the client needs. And that is what a solution is. Secret sauce on its own is a product. Technology on its own is a product. And without a client, there is no solution. So blending those three together creates a solution. And we now have these unbelievable clients where we work incredibly closely with. And it's been this incredible adventure for us. And also allows us to think about the synergies between that and our single manager craft business. Because of course, if we could buy an internal PAM manager and not charge any fees, then they're getting active management for cheaper than an ETF. You know, this concept of you're good enough to own, you might be good enough to home. And that's what we've done. So there is a symbiotic loop between those two businesses, but that is where that $21 billion is today. It's almost exactly split between technology-enabled advisor solutions and these single managers craft solutions, which are actually predominantly sold to institutional investors around the world, in North America, in the Middle East, in Canada, South Africa, et cetera.
Now, one of the challenges, and I do remember it very well, is that you put different managers together and you get egos in the room. And, you know, that's not always easy. You are fusing experience, opinion, egos, you know, and whilst you're giving them rein, you are trying to get a cohesive culture. Talk a little bit about how hard that's been and what have you learned that makes it easier?
We definitely learned lots. I think one of the hardest things when we talk to fund managers that want to join us is not the economics, and it's not the performance, because everyone thinks they're going to deliver a great performance, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. It's convincing them that it's not only economically better for them to work for a firm like ours than it is doing it for themselves, but it is going to give them much greater levels of creativity to focus on what they're doing well. And to do that, we have to leave them alone and we have to let them focus on what they want to do. And you have to nurture that talent. And that's what it is. We are championing the talent. We're not championing Pacific Asset Management. We're not trying to disintermediate the talent, which so many asset managers often have to do because they don't want the money to flow in and out with the talent. We are championing the talent. We're saying it's all about the talent. And therefore, we have to make sure we genuinely give them independence and we give them all that support. And the more independence you give them and the more space you give them, and that means that some people might be in their own offices, some people might be within our offices because they like the camaraderie of brainstorming, some might gravitate from our office to their own office. But we're not worried about that. We want to make sure that they're given all the toolkits to deliver. And then if we give them every toolkit they need to deliver, whether that's research, whether it's technology, it's infrastructure, their own space, everything they need to deliver, then the responsibility for delivering is 100% on them. And what have we learned? We were probably too dogmatic at the beginning. I think we were so protective that, you know, that we were an asset manager and everyone had to work for us and it had to be, and actually in reality, what we wanted was a culture of that we work together. And actually the culture says that they don't actually have to work for PAM. I mean, Coolabah is a fantastic example. We've raised nearly $2 billion in 18 months with Coolabah. And, we have this, we structured a joint venture that allowed us to feel like we were part of the family. I remember Chris Joy said to me, Matt, we may not be brothers in our home analogy, but we're definitely cousins. And once we'd done that, the incentive for him to disintermediate distribution or to not share data or to disappears because he's got to sort of pay us regardless. And for us, there isn't that platform, you know, them and us sort of culture. And we champion them as if they were in the building and working with us every time. So we've learned a lot about thinking about how you can create that culture without everyone necessarily having a PAM badge and being in the room. Last thing is, you know, I'm not the boss. You know, someone's got to be in charge of talking to shareholders, but it is genuinely a partnership. You know, we empower everybody. And if you empower people, people tend to enjoy it, right from the technologists through to fund management. I remember once bouncing out the lift into our office and saying to myself, like, if just being a sensible, nice human being is what makes a good business, then it's actually pretty easy to build a good business. But so many people fail on those sort of things.
And equally, for all of the merits that you've described, it is not going to be right for everybody. How quickly do you pick that up when you interview a team, and what might be for you, for them, the red flags?
We ended up working with a business called Tourbillon who came into PAM, but under the Tourbillon brand. Global value managers, amazing individuals, passed all those tests and that we talked about earlier. But one of the things Ramesh said to me, he said, look, it might be irrational, but I like this idea of Tourbillon being, you know, independent and its own thing. It's our baby, and we've got things that we want to do around, you know, charitable giving and succession planning and all those sort of things. So actually we structured something with them where they had their separate LLP and the separate partnership within our partnership, where they have ExCos, where they could protect their IP and what was really important to them. And so we do come across a lot of things that sometimes we think are irrational, other people think irrational. If the talent's great, we will work around to make sure that works. If it's unworkable for them or us, then we have to make that decision quickly. I should say that it's an extremely inexact science.
Right.
You know, picking talent is really, really tough. If it was easy, all those multi-asset managers would, you know, be delivering excellent returns every year. And so it is really tough. And a big part of it is about the culture and their enthusiasm and drive to making it work.
So back to the technology, because you, if I have understood your materials right, suggest that your investment managers are almost as technologically enabled as people who are nominally the technology people. One of the challenges around that is that some people either don't associate with the technology or don't want to associate. So, you know, it looks like a fantastic sort of discipline or skill set that you have managed to have these people acquire. But I can see there might be some pushback.
You're 100% right. So some fund managers have no interest in it at all. Some fund managers will tag data religiously and it's a really important part of their process. What I said to our technologists, which is very different, and the guy who runs our data came from Cantab, which was Goldman Sachs' hedge fund many years ago. And he runs all our data infrastructure, amazing person. And I said to him, look, you've got to come here. It's very different to everywhere you've been before. Because here your sole job is to build technology and infrastructure to make our business better. Whilst in the past, technology-enabled asset managers are usually building technology to make their investment decisions better. And there'll be some people that are fundamental in their investments and have no care about, you know, technology signals or factor analysis or the attribution or contribution or anything like that. And there are some that will be way more intrigued about that. The first goal for us was to make a platform where we own the data, you know, where that data is, you know, incredibly accurate. And we've spent, you know, we process 300 million data points a day, you know, 121 billion data points a year. And we use hundreds of visualization reports to find data that is wrong, because you ain't going to find data that's wrong on an Excel spreadsheet, particularly if you're someone that's got very little interest in it. But if you can fix data and make that data accurate and correct along the journey, then actually technology is quite cheap.
Yes, it was encapsulated in me talking to a financial institution, and I suggested that there were some things they might do just in their materials around, you know, delivering their message. And they said, well, the problem here is that technology is viewed as a cost center. And I think that that's back to your legacy systems.
Yes. I mean, actually, just one thing we haven't mentioned there, which is, you raise a great point. So the reason why in a traditional asset management business, two people get paid is because they're both seen as profit centers, you know, distribution and fund management. And, you know, the influence has swayed over time between one and the other. And I think everyone's worked out pretty much, you know, it's a fairly even story. And so everything else is seen as a cost center. And so, you know, we have technologists, you know, PhD, first class imperial maths technologists, people that have come from hedge funds, and we were started. And so there was no physical way to afford these people. And we felt that technology should be a profit center. So every bit of revenue that comes into our business, we will assign a proportion of that revenue to technology. And we have a technology division, and then we have equity that we give to our technologists in that division. So their compensation is linked to the profits of that division. And that has been allowed us to hire a completely different sort of technologist. That's how we managed to get, you know, some of those super bright people that historically may have been attracted to the banks. It's how we've taken really bright technologists out of, you know, Microsoft and Google. And, you know, we took an amazing lady who looked at the thermal efficiency of various different materials and was a maths and computer science major. And she joined us because there's alignment and there is the ability to have ownership and empowerment and creativity, which is what young people want. And if you do that and you've got a great technology stack, you can hire increasingly younger people because that's what they want to be part of. If you are a legacy stored procedure, SQL type infrastructure, or God forbid, have no database at all, or rented the database to some OMS system or something like that, then really your technologists are sitting in the corner doing mundane, you know, reconciliation type jobs. And so you'll never be able to get hire the talent in that space.
So you've been very clear on how you've, the architecture that you've used, the principles. Let's just talk about distribution, because that is, you know, absolutely key to asset management success. No being great, no good being great manager, managing a tiny pool of money unless it's just your own.
Yes.
So how have you thought about something that hasn't changed as much, but where technology can facilitate, and but maybe, you know, maybe the human element is as important as ever?
So I think the human element is definitely as important as ever. I think distribution has changed, not in any way trying to offend anyone, but I think, you know, we've moved away rightly from lunches and, you know, social relationships into something that is more solutions orientated, and it's a more technical sell. A more technical sell requires, you know, more moving parts. So it's a really good example of that. We've had a lot of success in North America. We've listed an active ETF with our emerging market team, which has just gone through 200 million in just about 12 months, which is, you know, amazing given, you know, there are many active ETFs launched. But we were talking to one of the big US endowments who wanted an EM mandate, and they wanted it ex-China. And because we index everything within the business, I could tell them the actual P&L of our portfolio instantaneously, pretty much, on what the actual stocks that we picked were, and the actual P&L of the stocks we picked. And then we could turn around and say, well, what was the geographic exposures and the industrial exposures of that over time? So suddenly you end up saying, well, wait a second, this is our Taiwanese and Korea portfolio, if you end up scaling up your, and then you can start putting collars and caps around that. And then we're building indices using actual P&L directly in front of them. And then suddenly they go, okay, we really believe you can do this, when typically they would have required at least a 3-year track and a seg mandate like that. The next thing, we won 300 million from a very large US prestigious endowment. Then they asked us, you know, we don't want to do a seg mandate. Can we do a Cayman? And so then we're doing a Cayman, and it's effectively a fund of one. And then we have the ability to launch new structures, launch new share classes across jurisdictions. And the technology allows you to do that without constantly having to hire more people. And the final bit on distribution, I guess, is that not only do I think as the sell changed and the technology enables the sell, but the world, you know, maybe this is an ironic thing to say in today's environment, but I do think the world is increasingly globalized. And as a result, you know, global financial institutions do not want to write, you know, support or sign off a product in the US that's completely different to the UK, which is different to Asia, which is different for their retail clients, and another different one for their high net worth clients. What they want to do is find the best possible process and then use people like us to productionize that process for the different client bases. So within emerging markets, we have Cayman for high net worths. We have UCITS for cross-border Europe and Asia, where they buy UCITS. And we have LLCs for endowments and foundations in the US with ERISA compliance and QPAM status. And we also have an active ETF for the retail or those that are interested in instantaneous liquidity. That means I can go to any institution. They can look at the strategy as a whole, knowing they've got a vehicle to buy regardless of where their end clients are in the world. And building that infrastructure and building LLCs and Caymans and UCITS and active ETFs is historically labor intensive unless you've got great technology and infrastructure. And on top of that, we've got about 16 segregated mandates that we also price daily using a NAV. And so we can report and we do seg mandate fact sheets and things like that. So all of that makes us a much easier person to deliver. But, you know, without performance and without great talent, you know, we still would never be raising money.
And staying with technology, is it noticeable to you how AI is enhancing anything that you do?
So we actually have an AI presentation. We're doing a lot on this tomorrow with the whole office. What are my two thoughts? I think AI increases productivity. I think that is for certain. Let's separate it in two ways. One is it going to make it create better investment decisions? And the other one is, can it create productivity in other ways? So firstly, does it increase margins? Does it create better productivity? I think the way you need to think about this is if you've got super structured data with well-structured open APIs, then you will, I think, continue to own your data forever. If your data is incorrect, poorly structured, and you don't have an API type led infrastructure, then somebody else is going to own your data. Because what's going to happen is you're going to have to bring somebody else in to take all that unstructured data and pay them to structure it using things like AI. But that means effectively you've given them your data. Whilst if we can own our data, then there is an argument that much of the AI becomes industrialized. And then we can choose what access our API endpoints in the most cost efficient and margin enhancing way. So I think whatever happens, until the AI can walk into an asset management business and says, I know what this means, and I'm just going to build your database and deliver it. We're quite a long way away from that. Then I think there's then owning your data is mission critical. On the investment side, wow, who knows? I mean, there was a great FT article this week where the journalist had written about how he'd worked, you know, with AI and built his own portfolio. Now, he had written two articles on this and got a lot of abuse online about how it's all about face-to-face and real expertise and you shouldn't do this. And he effectively then released what the AI had built in his portfolio, which was 60% equities and 40% bonds, and which had obviously the AI had learned from a lot of work that's on the internet, which talks about 60-40, and actually hadn't solved any problem at all, because on any banking app or trading app, I can buy a 60-40 portfolio bond run by one of those industrialized players in a second. In fact, the time he took him to write that article, or the two articles, he probably missed out on 3% of returns. So I don't actually think that's solving anything. What I do think is good output is a function of good input. And the more input and throughput you can put through the system, it is likely that that should lead to better outputs. And I think that's where it can help investments. It can speed up that whole throughput process. More idea generation, more throughput should lead to better output.
Well, we were lucky enough to interview Howard Marks last year, and he has just released a paper you may have already seen. It's free, and that's on the future of AI and investing. And it's, you know, it's very, very cleverly and well-judged, you know, recognizing all of those uncertainties and some of the, you know, maybe unrealistic extrapolations. But I think if anybody who's just trying to understand this space, it's a must read. We'll probably attach it to the the article. I've got some wider questions as we move towards the, you know, the close, which is how different might our industry look in a handful of years?
There's more and more capital, and I think there's fewer and fewer allocators of capital. So that's an interesting thing around what it means for distribution and what it means for strategic relationships. There are people that have lots of product might end up in deeper strategic relationships with firms. That might be difficult for boutiques because you end up with less allocators, but more capital means that they would end up taking far too much of a boutique's fund. You know, there are three or four wealth managers now that have all merged together, are owned by one bank as of a few weeks ago. And so I think I do think this consolidation of asset owners has implications to think about. I think there are real signs and long that we are seeing that passive investing has, you know, when an active manager outperforms meaningfully out of passive, there's this big who lies passive dead and everyone talks about it. And then the next year passive outperforms the active manager and they go, we missed that one. I think what people tend not to notice is things that creep up on you. And there are these amazing statistics now that are coming out that actually, you know, over one, three, and five years, our multi-asset team are outperforming 60/40 pure passive by the big players, both on a return and a risk-adjusted basis, a lower risk, more diversification. And I think that some of these indices have become very stretched. And I don't think, you know, I think there are stats that over the last 5 years, I think UK equities is up around about the same amount as the S&P 500. Yes. And people haven't worked that out. You know, I think a world where the dollar's not necessarily going to be the reserve currency in a deglobalization world, that means US investors will get the double whammy that we've had for many years, which is buying US equities and getting a stronger dollar. And they could be buying European equities and getting a stronger euro or sterling. So I think there is definitely hope and life. And I think some of it is actually happening without people necessarily realizing it. The last point to mention is that if you have fewer allocators of capital, how do they manage that in a scalable and efficient way? And I think the one point to take away globally is that models are coming for everyone. Yeah. I think, you know, OCIO for retail, OCIO for institutional, model portfolios for on platforms, there will be all over the world, the world is moving to models. And that means marginal money could flow much faster than it has in the past, because asset allocation shifts, I think, could be done much quicker.
Well, I was nodding vigorously as you talked about that deglobalizing sort of, you know, other parts of the world being better value, but that might be just me in my echo chamber.
Yeah, it might be me too.
But you've given a very nice answer, thank you, to that question about, you know, what the industry might look like. For you and your business, you have a new custodian with Pinnacle. How do you want your business to look, and what would give you great pleasure in 5 years' time?
So let's touch on Pinnacle. Pinnacle have been in my, I've known them for 4 or 5 years. We met them through Coolabah and Maple Brown Abbott, and they've been a minority shareholder for the last 18 months or so. And we're doing interesting things. And our previous shareholder, you know, I think had been a long way on the journey. And, you know, I think they were keen to make sure that we had an appropriate custodian for the next part of the journey. So John's not getting any younger. And I think that this was very much a mutually agreed discussion. And frankly, there was nobody else that we would have ever considered. That cultural similarities are uncannily similar. They believe in supported independence. They believe in championing talent. They're incredibly nice and decent people, which is a big part of what we wanted to do. And although they wanted to take out our largest shareholder and all the PAM people really still have skin in the game at the PAM level, what was really important to us is that despite them effectively being our sole shareholder, that they would give us the independence we wanted, and actually wrote in vetoes into our legal agreements that, you know, allowed me to have equal powers and voting rights and decisions with them to really protect our, you know, our independence and work out where that journey leads over time. So I think that's been a great success, and we're super excited about that. It's a sort of a no change scenario. What would make me happy? You know, I love technology, and the more people that engage with our technology, both within our business and outside of our business, I think means that all that hard work sort of has a tangible payoff. You know, the asset management business is quite intangible. You know, we're selling educated guesses in many ways. Mm-hmm. And the technology part is the tangible part of what we do. So the continued adoption of things like Advisor Lab and our retail technology, which is really going nuts at the moment, I think would make me very proud. I think if we could deliver the model portfolio version or retail version of Aladdin, that would be a great win for us. And then I think making sure that we stay true to our foundation and those three principles about finding great craft talent and growing it. You know, people ask me like, how much craft talent is there out there? And, you know, if you look at it mathematically, if a fund manager gets it wrong every 10 years and I have 10 craft fund management businesses, I've probably got a problem every year. But if I have one, I'm betting everything on one. And so I don't think we're going to be rolling out tons and tons of hard to industrialize craft-based strategies. That's sort of oxymoronic. But at the same time, we're not going to sit there passively and just hope we raise a load of money in one or two. So that's what I'd like to be challenged about in 5 years' time, to make sure that we stuck to our principles and that culture we talked about right at the beginning. And you have to be like uber disciplined. I remember when I was running a big chunk of the sales for GAM, and occasionally people would, you know, ask me if I was interested in moving. And, you know, one of the things I always used to tell myself is that if I thought the success I was having, if I pinned down the success I was having was a third luck, a third the brand and the people that I worked with, and a third me, then two thirds of that is sort of not really controllable, you know, and therefore you probably don't move jobs a lot. And I think that has been a good measure for me to make sure that we don't believe our own hype and we completely remain grounded. A huge amount of what we've done has been an incredible team at Pacific. You know, in a world where active asset managers were bleeding money, you know, for 9 years, we've grown a 60% annualized growth rate, you know, $21.3 billion. It's been unbelievably hard work, but we've had a huge amount of luck, you know, to get to where we're doing. We've worked incredibly, you know, hard. And it's about that collaboration. And I remember talking to the team recently saying, the weird thing is when we started, we couldn't do anything other than believe because we didn't have anything to lose. And the problem is you start to make mistakes when you think about protecting what you've got and you lose that collaboration and belief. And so for us, it's constantly reminding each other that we need, of course, a dollop of institutionalization as we grow, and you know that requires HR and you know more people in finance and all those sort of things, and you know committees and operational infrastructure, and that's sort of what we're committed to doing. But if we lose that element of collaboration and energy, then we lose everything, and that's the bit that we have to constantly remind ourselves. And as long as I'm here, and my colleagues that helped us build this business are here, we will make sure that we can do that.
Well, that's a great summary from you. I mean, you have created a terrific business, so well done to you and your colleagues. If I were to make three concluding remarks, which apply to the industry that so many of us, you know, have lived in for a long time, it's that when you said, to paraphrase you, a model portfolio is coming your way, it's actually the conclusion of that is that the marginal money flows could be larger and speedier than we have got used to, number one. Number two is that the consolidation of the asset owners, you know, we're seeing it between public and private, although there may be a hiccup with the privates, you know, right now, maybe the publics will have their revenge, but you know, that is upon us and is a secular, I think, not a cyclical trend. And that there is still room for the craft-based, you know, managers sitting, you know, technologically enhanced, but alongside, you know, various other, you know, forms of managing money in a way that, you know, allows for efficiency and margin retention.
Completely. You've got to provide a home that is with the least friction and the highest operating margins possible in an environment where the world is being dominated by industrialization.
Matt, it's been great having you here.
Thank you so much.